Tonight on the Daily Debrief.
State of Iowa versus Cheyenne Harris.
A verdict against the woman who says she was doing drugs as her baby was dying in the next room. Is it murder or mere negligence?
We, the jury, find the defendant.
Plus, more legal proceedings against the Wisconsin judge acquitted of stalking. You recognize him from Making a Murderer. Also, the daughter of a serial killer.
It was flat out, your dad is BTK.
Speaks about how she's managed to forgive him. And the computer enhancements in the trial of a man accused of murdering an entire family. This is the Daily Debrief for Thursday, February 7th.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Debrief tonight. A guilty verdict late yesterday in the case of the admitted meth mommy accused of murdering her baby by neglecting him and leaving him to die. Prosecutors say four-month-old Zachary Cohen died in a child swing because his mother, Cheyenne Harris, and his father, Zachary Cohen, stopped feeding him and left him to rot in his own feces. It was a case filled with emotional testimony and gruesome pictures of the baby's remains. One of Harris's defense attorneys had strong reactions to some of the autopsy photos. Her arms were crossed, her back to her client at various times during that case. What message did that body language send to the jury? That is a big question. Harris now joins the child's father, Zachary, as a convicted killer. The jury in Zachary Keene's case returned guilty verdicts as well. Cohen took the stand and blamed Cheyenne Harris for the child's death. Harris did not take the stand in her own case. Harris's attorney read Zachary Cohen's testimony into the record in the case against Harris. Let's go back to closing arguments now, where prosecutors said that little Sterling Cohen should have been a blessing to his mother.
On May 1st, 2017, the defendant was given a blessing, a baby boy, a healthy, happy, innocent baby boy. Now that you have heard all of the evidence, it should be clear to you that the defendant didn't want the responsibility of that blessing, that she didn't accept the responsibility of that blessing, and that she let her blessing die a slow and painful and unnecessary death. And just as during Sterling's life, when the defendant took no responsibility for him, it's the same in his death. That's why we're here, because she doesn't take responsibility for his death. Actions and consequences, that's what this is about. You, as the jury, will soon be in the position to decide what her actions were and what are the consequences. Is it guilty? Is it not guilty?
Not long after that, the prosecution cut straight to the disgusting details of the little boy's death.
You know, maybe some of you in the beginning of this case, when you heard maggots, you thought, well, he died and they left him in the swing for a long time, and that's why there's maggots. Well, you know now from the evidence, that's not the case, right? Dr. Klein said based on the rigor, Sterling could have been dead for up to 8 hours. Maybe a day. Because had he been dead longer, he would have looked differently. He would have been bloated. The rigor, he would have been stiff. It would have gone away by that point. Right? He had just died. Dr. Huntington talked about facultative meiosis, infestation of the living. And that's what he saw in this case. Had Sterling been dead for an extended period of time, there would have been blowfly infestation, not scuttlefly infestation. He also would have seen the flies in Sterling's nose and his ears and things like that. It would have looked different. So Dr. Huntington can tell you from the insects that he was only dead a half day to a day. And the entire rest of the time, he was alive, going through a painful, horrendous death while two adults were in another room. This was torture. This was cruel. There's absolutely no question.
The defense had argued that the facts of this case were not severe enough to result in a conviction on murder charges. The defense said this was negligence, not something willful.
What is the difference between first-degree murder and child endangerment causing death? The argument that I heard is that they're one and the same. But that is not true. Iowa recognizes a distinction. We have a statute that says child endangerment causing death is a crime. We reserve the most infamous crime in the state of Iowa, first-degree murder, for the most violent acts, the most violent of people. We convict people of child endangerment causing death when they are negligent and willfully deprive them of care, which is exactly what happened in this case.
The defense also employed a last-ditch effort tactic, admitting guilt on a lesser charge in an attempt to avoid a more serious conviction.
What's important is the idea that Ms. Harris is not taking responsibility. That is not true. She looks back on what was happening in that era and realizes I was really messed up. And we are not disputing that. She was really messed up. And because she was really messed up, and because of the choices that she made, because she did willfully deprive Sterling of critical care, we are not arguing that. The facts of this case support a conviction for count two. Read it. It's exactly what happened in this case. We accept responsibility for that conviction. That's what happened. When people know that they've done wrong, they like to feel that there's been a balance, that they pay for what the wrong that they did. We accept the conviction for count two. The reason that we're here, and the reason that we've taken a week and a half out of your life, is because it is not murder. The acceptance of responsibility requires, and Ms. Harris accepts, the conviction for child endangerment causing death. Justice, the finding of truth, requires the finding of not guilty for murder in the first degree, because there is no murder without malice.
During a rebuttal, the prosecution hit two key points. First, that this defendant's other child was completely healthy, and second, that she was hiding her baby boy from the drug dealer who started a romantic relationship with her.
There's a happy, healthy baby girl in that house while her baby boy lay rotting in the back room. Depression doesn't work that way. You don't pick and choose like that. Could it be because she didn't want him in the first place? Could be. Could it be her only care was pleasing Zach? Could be. Could it be that she wanted out of that apartment? She wanted back on the road with Zach and all, and Sterling was getting in the way of that? Could be. But the point is, it doesn't matter. All of those would be reasonable inferences, but the why doesn't matter. And does it change anything? Jordan Clark, he was in the apartment at least two times doing meth with the defendant while Sterling was in the back room, and he had no idea they had a baby. And you could stay up for nights, for weeks, for months trying to figure out how another human being can do this to a child. But you're never going to find yourself a good answer. And the only thing you're going to do is lose sleep. Okay? The why doesn't matter.
Joining me tonight is attorney Jim Breslow, host of the podcast Hidden Truth. So, Jim, it's guilty across the board for this particular defendant, guilty of murder, guilty of the lesser charge. Interesting tactic, though, from the defense, which we see from time to time, accepting guilt on the lesser charge to try to dodge the top charge. Didn't work here.
Yeah, it's sadness all the way around, obviously, for the baby, but frankly also for this mother. Clearly she had an addiction problem. Clearly there were mental health issues. I think what the real killer for her in the case is the fact that she had the other child in that she demonstrated the ability to take care of that child. So any hope of getting any type of insanity type plea just went out the window with the demonstrated ability to take care of the other child.
A lot of people agree. I agree. And look, that was a key piece of evidence for the state. Some debate over the law here. The state trying to say that the law makes child endangerment into murder if the baby dies, which is how I read the statute as well. The defense seeming to say, no, that's not the way the law operates there. It needs actions, including malice. That argument may have flown over some of the jurors' heads, but it might be helpful on appeal.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you need intent for murder. And there clearly seems to be enough evidence here to prove an intention to leave this child to die. We all know that a baby cannot survive on its own. She's raised another child. She knows what it takes to raise a child. So it seems to me there's your intent right there.
Good point there as well. Okay, the state's rebuttal, in my opinion, should have gone into this whole love triangle situation here, because one interesting thing that came up in this case that, of course, we didn't hear in the father's case is that the mother, this defendant, started a relationship with the drug dealer basically right after this happened, and the drug dealer said he knew nothing about the baby. Now, they were really clear to say that this relationship didn't bud until after the baby was out of the way, but boy, I mean, could that have been the reason why the mother didn't want the baby around?
Yeah, that would perhaps be an explanation. You know, the only other explanation is insanity. How a mother could not raise a child is beyond most people's comprehension. But, you know, when drugs enter the picture and mental health enters the picture, we see people doing horrendous things, and it just demonstrates, you know, the mental health crisis that we have in America as you look at all these different crimes that are happening and the mental health issues that are involved in them.
Yeah, it'll be sentencing next in this case. Jim Breslow will check in with you again at the end of the broadcast. Still ahead tonight here on the Daily Debrief, a serial killer's daughter speaks to Law and Crime about her path to forgiveness despite all she has endured. Plus, America's 80s dad has a new home in prison. We'll tell you where Bill Cosby is living these days when the debrief continues. Welcome back, everybody. Officers arrested a man in court today in the federal criminal trial of El Chapo. The accused drug kingpin remains waiting as jurors deliberate his fate on criminal enterprise and murder conspiracy charges. Today, a man claiming to be one of his relatives sat in a space reserved for El Chapo's wife. A U.S. marshal ordered that man to leave. Court security learned he had an open warrant and arrested him. El Chapo gained notoriety for escaping from a prison cell in Mexico long before he was charged and tried here in the United States. Also today in the El Chapo case, a defense attorney for El Chapo tweeted this from a law firm account. It's a bottle of tequila shaped like a gun. The message, this is for after the trial. Disgraced comedian and convicted sex offender Bill Cosby has a new home behind bars. Pennsylvania prison officials have moved Cosby to a general population area in the prison system. Other inmates have been ordered to provide him aid during the day because of his age and physical condition, the Associated Press reports. Cosby is 81 and is legally blind. He was previously housed in a special unit at a correctional facility near Philadelphia. A hearing today for a Wisconsin attorney and judge who gained international reputations through the Netflix film Making a Murderer. Len Kaczynski is facing a professional conduct complaint regarding his treatment of a clerk who worked for him. A jury acquitted Kaczynski of felony stalking charges in December related to that case. The Wisconsin Judicial Commission is pushing forward with disciplinary proceedings against Kaczynski. An evidence hearing in that discipline case is today and tomorrow, and any additional time needed. Sentencing tomorrow for the Ohio woman convicted of murdering her military husband. Claudia Herrig took the stand and admitted she pulled the trigger before fleeing to Brazil. The question in her case was whether her actions were premeditated or a fit of rage. The penalties are vastly different. The jury sided with the prosecution and found that the crime was premeditated. Herrig could face life in prison under state law, but her extradition deal with Brazil might complicate things. Expect live coverage of this sentencing tomorrow on Law and Crime and a recap here on the Daily Debrief. The daughter of the infamous BTK serial killer was our guest recently on the Law and Crime Network. My colleague Bob Bianchi spoke with her about her new book and her path toward forgiveness.
It was shocking to you, right? This wasn't dad to you.
No, I mean, I only knew the man we were talking about, the one I fished and camped with, and he was like my best friend that I walked the dog with, and I was very close to him. And so when the FBI showed up at my door, you know, February of 2005, like, I told him they had the wrong guy. I tried to alibi him, and I was just fell into physical shock. My whole world just fell out under me.
Yeah, I remember a passage in a book where, like, the FBI comes up. He was an agent that wasn't really a field agent, so they kind of threw him out there.
No.
And they hit all your family at one time.
They did. It was all coordinated because they were pretty sure it was my dad a week before they arrested him. Then they got my DNA and confirmed it, and then the next day they had it all coordinated. So they picked my dad up. Picked up my mom for questioning, notified me and notified my brother in Connecticut of the naval school at the same time.
Right. So, I mean, and I think the FBI said something like, your dad is BTK.
Yeah, like, he just dropped in on me. He was like, have you heard of BTK? And so I thought maybe something had happened to my grandma because she lived alone. And then he just drops it because he realizes I'm not getting it. He's like, your dad is BTK. It wasn't like he's being investigated, he's being questioned. It was flat out, your dad is BTK.
Talk to me about your path a little bit with God. A lot in this book you talk about you wrestled with the concepts of God, I think when your cousin had died, mm-hmm. and where is God. But you started to come to a faith-based formation prior to your dad being arrested. Is that about right?
It is. I mean, I grew up in a small Lutheran church, and it was very important that my dad took us to church. And I mean, it seems really ironic now, but it was very important that we went to church every Sunday, and he served as like an usher in communion. So I grew up with that, and then I walked from faith. Then we were in the Grand Canyon when I was 19, and it was one of Dad's crazy ideas to go hike down there for a week, and we got into a lot of trouble. Could have all lost our lives because, you know, my dad's leading us into this dangerous situation. Bound down there is where I found God. I prayed, and he answered my prayers. So then I established actually a strong foundation of faith, you know, between 97 and 05. So then when my dad was arrested, there wasn't anything left. I didn't know how I was going to survive, you know, the first night. And my faith was there, you know, just crying out to God. And, you know, he gave me Psalm 23 that first night about walking through the valley of the shadow of death. And after that, every time I prayed out to God, you know, he just gave me something to hold on to get me through.
It seems like you went through a whole epiphany of things that happened in reading so many sections of your book. Part of it says, for all those who suffer from unhealed wounds or the crippling effects of violence, betrayal, anger, your story offers hope at reclaiming sanity in the midst of the madness. Talk to me about when you love, because that's where that comes from, right. Corinthians. Love never fails. Love is perfect, right?
Right.
Talk to us about, you came to the final conclusion in your soul that you still love your dad, even though he has done these horrible things. Talk to us about
right. that. Love never fails was our verse when we got married, and it was on the wall. On the day of my dad's arrest, it was behind me when I was falling apart. It said, love never fails, and it was on my ring, and I grabbed my ring. I still love my father because the only man I know was a mainly good and decent man. So when people are shocked that I still love my father, I'm telling you, I love Dennis Rader. I love my dad. I don't know BTK.
Right.
If I knew BTK, I probably wouldn't be alive.
That forgiveness is the thing that actually sets you free.
Right. The enemy, as in Satan walking on the earth till Christ comes back from a Christian standpoint, is going to want to try to keep you down, keep you angry, keep you mad, keep you rotted. He wants you to die. So you can't, you have to fight him and not let him win. And so love wins.
That entire interview is on lawandcrime.com. Now to the case of the Southern California man accused of killing all four members of the McStay family. Charles Chase Merritt was a business associate to father and husband Joseph McStay. First, the McStays disappeared. Then, authorities believe they may have fled to Mexico to avoid debts. Police even pointed to this video shot near the border as evidence that the family may have skipped to the other side. Then, authorities backtracked when a dirt biker stumbled across the family's remains buried in the Mojave Desert. Prosecutors claim the defendant killed for money. Late yesterday, the jury heard testimony from a state analyst who enhanced security camera footage from a neighbor's house. The enhancement shows what prosecutors are arguing is the defendant's truck in the neighborhood where the McStays lived. Traffic in their area is rare because the family lived on a dead-end cul-de-sac. The state believes the family was indeed murdered in their home. Also yesterday, a QuickBooks customer representative testified via Skype that someone claiming to be Joseph McStay called to cancel his business's accounts after McStay disappeared. It's unclear who placed the call. The defense says another man beside this defendant had his hands on Joseph McStay's company's financials. That other man, named Dan Kavanaugh, is the defense's alternate suspect. Back one more time tonight with attorney Jim Breslow. So, Jim, who exactly did this here? We've got one man on trial without a lot of evidence directly pointing to him and another possible suspect the defense is naming. What do you think?
Yeah, it's an interesting dichotomy because the strength of the apparent case versus the defendant, Merritt, seems to be similar to the strength of the case against this other potential defendant, Kavanaugh. I think the defense has to be careful pushing too much toward the Kavanaugh angle because the evidence of his guilt is just as weak. So you don't want to make the mistake perhaps the prosecution is doing, which is bringing a case that is relatively weak against this defendant, but then on the same hand saying that, oh, Kavanaugh did it based on similar evidence.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be a really interesting case as it grinds along here. This supposition that the family died in the family's home, no blood. They've got these little tiny suspected dots of what might be blood, but they didn't notice them until the pictures were enlarged. No testing has been done, and yet they seem to be sticking with this theory. And what of these pieces of fabric that they found in the grave that they think might just possibly be the missing towels from the family's residence? Again, it's evidence that this family is dead. Well, we know that. How does it point the finger at Chase Merritt?
Exactly. And what's incredible in this case is that the San Diego County Police said that this house was not a crime scene. They didn't even put crime tape up. They allowed multiple people to go in. They allowed the mother to go in and clean this house. Now, San Bernardino police are saying it's not only a crime scene, it's actually where the murders of this entire family took place. And yet, there's hardly a shred of evidence of it there. Furthermore, the bodies would have had to have been transported, presumably in the defendant's car. They've got no evidence of any DNA in that car, and they've got no evidence of Merritt at the ultimate place where the bodies were
found. It's a big whodunit. Jim Breslow, appreciate your insight tonight on The Debrief.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks for watching again tonight. I'll see you right back here at either 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock on the Law and Crime Network. Our schedule here depends on testimony in the McStay family murder case, which continues into the evening. Up next, Brian Ross Investigates, right here on the Law and Crime Network.